Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, the television podcast from Vanity Fair that today will be about not just one show, not just several shows, but an entire galaxy of shows that are coming in the near future, so to speak. And I am Katie Rich. I am the awards and audio editor for Vanity Fair. And there's really only one person I could be doing this with, Anthony Bresnahan, fresh from a galaxy far, far away. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here. You know, I didn't just write it, but we just published the cover story for the June issue, and it's all about Star Wars and, as you said, this constellation of shows that's emerging on the horizon. And so there's a lot to talk about.
Including one very close on the horizon, which is Obi-Wan Kenobi, which premieres on May 27th on Friday on Disney Plus. We are recording this immediately before that show premieres, even though you wrote this massive cover story about Star Wars. You have not seen it. I don't think you're lying to me that that Lucasfilm gave you access. You really haven't seen it, right?
No, they've kept it under wraps. I'll see it Friday at Celebration.
Oh, yeah. Wow. What a Star Wars
weekend. Star Wars
ahead.
Convention that draws people from all over the world.
There's really so much to get into. And I feel really grateful that we're starting where we are, because I'm someone who is Star Wars. I know things about Star Wars, but extremely casually. I have seen a good bit of it, but not all of it. And I feel like I always need a new starting point, and this feels like a great point.
That's a great place to be. You know, I know a lot about Star Wars. I've written about it for years and years, but I don't know as much as some fans. And I think that's okay, because I have questions and there are things I don't know and things I'm curious about. And it's a good way to be a bridge between the creators, the hardcore fans, and the casual people, which is the majority of people. You know, most people have a friendly relationship with Star Wars, and yet they don't know everything there is to know about it. And we can tell you what you need to know. And of course, there's much more beyond that. It's funny to be this close to a Star Wars series that's new and not be doing this show with Joanna Robinson, though. So I just have to shout out our former. Our former friend, she's not our friend anymore, our former colleague and forever friend, Joanna.
And the founder of this show, who is here with us, always in spirit. But, you know, Anthony, I think our the spirit of Luke Skywalker, who's been digitized and brought into the cloud and brought back when needed. I think we have a little bit of Joanna that can
is she a force ghost?
if there was ever an episode of Still Watching for Force Ghost Joanna, let's hear a bit of our Force Ghost Joanna with us today. Oh.
I'm Joanna Robinson, and pew, 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 pew.
We have a Joanna Robinson soundboard. Fortunately, we are going to digitize her voice. We're going to create an AI, and we'll just have the VF robot Joanna that joins us on all these podcasts.
Unfortunately, she's
she's
the one who would say smart things, and I'm the one who would go pew, pew, pew. So it's kind of unfair. Thank you to our producer, Dave Gonzalez. Also, current friend of Joanna's for helping us with that magic trick.
And
Joanna will ask you your permission later to make sure it's okay that we put that
sick, dope, tight.
There it is. We've gotten the approval. Thank you, AI Joanna.
Well, and also Joanna is a long time fan of Ewan McGregor. And I know she's been talking about Obi-Wan over on the Ringerverse and her new Universal podcast, but I do feel like it is right to have her spirit with us as Ewan McGregor returns to Star Wars, something that I think a lot of people never thought would happen. I think Ewan McGregor never thought would happen. So we're going to get into the full Star Wars universe, but I do think we should start with Obi-Wan,
which
is premiering the soonest.
And I'm glad you gave her podcast on Ringerverse a shout out, because if we're going to assimilate her into our show, we should at least shout out where she is now over at the Ringer. She just did a great epic podcast about just about the history of Obi-Wan. So after you finish listening to us, go dive into that if you need more of your Obi-Wan fix. So
Absolutely. Love
to you, Joanna.
So let's talk about Ewan McGregor, I think, to start with, because in your big Star Wars piece, you know, he talked about how he was really hesitant to return to this character for so long. And it was maybe 5 years ago where he introduced a screening and thought, hey, this character means a lot. And the feeling that I got maybe behind the reading between the lines is that the reception of the prequels really hurt him, and it took a long time to get over. Was that the vibe you got too?
Totally. And I think it also it shows just how people change over time. You know, in talking to him, I was reminded of Leonard Nimoy. And of course, he played the iconic character of Spock, the Vulcan chief science officer on Star Trek. And He wrote an autobiography, right, that was called I Am Not Spock. And then years later, he wrote a second autobiography that the title was I Am Spock. And and I think, you know, the relationship that people have with their characters, you know, when you have the whole world sees you in one way, the impulse is to be like, no, that's not me. I'm more than that. I'm different from that. Mm-hmm. And what Ewan told me was, you know, he was starring in all these sort of indie, gritty, actorly British dramas. He was like an indie film star. And then he's starring in Star Wars, which is this gigantic intellectual property franchise. And, you know, he loves Star Wars. I think he was always upfront about that and playing Obi-Wan Kenobi, picking up the mantle of that character from the
He was not like Alec Guinness, where as soon as he was done, he was like, fuck that.
Alec Guinness was like paying children to not watch Star Wars, you know, or urging them not to. You know, and also like, really, Alec, you gotta be like that down on it.
Yeah, but, he was not ready to be ahead of his time in terms of franchise filmmaking.
Yeah, but it's sort of like, you know, Ewan was sort of like, oh, I'll do this. And then the reaction to the prequels was the criticism was very harsh. And he told me, you know, that's hard to hear, especially when you have two more to do. Mm-hmm. And this is a thing that, you know, Hayden Christensen experienced when he was playing the older version of Anakin Skywalker. Star Wars fandom is vast. And I would say most Star Wars fans are respectful and decent people, but it's the loud and disruptive and unkind people who sometimes steal the megaphone and steal your attention, at least. And so, you know, if anybody's read interviews with Ahmed Best, who played the Jar Jar Binks character, you know, he went into a very dark place and was really hurt by some of the, not just criticism, but cruel things that people say. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the unfortunate things about these fandoms that are, I'm not just going to single out Star Wars here, but these sort of vast global fandoms is because they include so many people, they include a fair number of let's say unpleasant people or trolls too.
Sure.
And those people, they don't just say, I don't like this, or I don't care for that character, or I hope this character doesn't come back, or I don't care for this actor, or his performance isn't so great. They really get personal and they really get mean. Frankly, even when you write about Star Wars, you can pick up on this if you tune into those wavelengths, which is why I kind of tune them out.
Yeah.
Because sometimes people are just mean. And I think,
yeah, you won't have a Twitter handle to plug at the end of this because wisely you were not on Twitter.
I'm not on Twitter.
Which is a choice many more of us should make.
And I know some people are like, oh, were you driven off? It's like, no, I just kind of didn't want that in my head anymore. And I spent
you drove yourself off.
I closed up my own shop, you know, you know, I wasn't canceled or anything. Poor, I wasn't chased off Twitter, but I got to a point where I was like, you know, I just don't know that this is fruitful to hear, because you just get the angry people so often.
Well, and it feels like Ewan McGregor and Hayden Christensen had come to their own version of that, right?
Yes,
like they had
exactly.
let themselves move on until getting drawn back in like you do.
That's just it. And, you know, what's interesting is the prequels were very harshly criticized. And, you know, that affected George Lucas, too. He was like used to everybody loving Star Wars. And then he was getting a lot of heat. And, you know, the original Star Wars movies have just as much clunky stuff in them. And they're not perfect films, but they're fun. And what we found now over the years is as kids who grew up with the prequels have come of age and have become journalists or become critics or just used their individual platform as fans on social media, there's been a reevaluation of the prequels. Again, nobody's going to say they're perfect films, but they do have a special place in people's hearts. And I think that's what Ewan discovered when mm-hmm. he went and hosted, introduced, and I think maybe probably answered a few questions about Revenge of the Sith. A number of years ago, he saw people camping out and he was like, oh, maybe this thing that I kind of pushed off that I thought didn't work, maybe it does mean something to people. Mm-hmm. And he said, as he's gotten older, you know, he watched, I did a standalone story in addition to our main cover story where I broke out a lot of like the detail from these interviews that didn't fit into the already Titanic sized.
We'll talk about a bunch of those, especially as we get into some of these other shows.
One of the things he said was on the volume where they shot Obi-Wan, you know, they put on these giant screens, which are usually reserved for creating landscapes and sets. They were playing, old footage of Obi-Wan's greatest hits, including him as a young man and Alec Guinness. And this was done for one of those behind the scenes documentaries that I'm sure will come out in a few months. But he said it was really strange and really emotional to see himself as a young man and realize how much he has changed. And I think they're bringing all that to the Obi-Wan series. This is Obi-Wan in middle age. He's not the young Padawan apprentice with the little rat tail, the little braided thing that would hang down. That's the indicator of a Padawan learner. Yeah. Party in the back, I guess. but they're... you know, they're bringing this aspect to Obi-Wan of a guy who's really reevaluating his past. And in Ewan's crazy case, he reevaluated it in a very positive way and thought, yeah, you know what? I'd like to go back to Star Wars. Let's do it.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that's fascinating about what we know about Obi-Wan so far, we know, mm-hmm. you know, he's on Tatooine. It's obviously him in the age between Ewan McGregor of 25 years ago and Alec Guinness. And we know that Darth Vader's in it. And Hayden Christensen is in your piece. There's these incredible photos by Annie Leibovitz of him rehearsing backstage with his lightsaber. But we don't really know how or to what extent. And your story isn't able to reveal much. The trailer doesn't reveal very much. What are you hoping for or expecting in terms of how we revisit both of these characters?
Well, one of the things I was able to reveal is... you know, you want to be protective of storylines. I don't think the fans or even the casual fans want to have things told to them in an article that they would rather discover on their own. Right. Yeah. So but what I can reveal is that you don't hire Hayden Christensen to play Darth Vader. You need a big guy and the suit. And if you can get him, James Earl Jones to do the voice. But to play the human being that was lost within Darth Vader, this character who, you know, he's a cosmic space wizard, right? So that's not a lot that's relatable there. It's more entertaining and more fanciful than most of the things we encounter in our lives. But I do think we can all relate to the idea, the notion of a friend or a family member who goes to a dark place and we decide, I just can't run with you anymore, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want to know you anymore. We've all had that Facebook friend that we've had to unlike, unfollow. And Darth Vader is kind of that. And Hayden plays the Anakin Skywalker, the human being, the decent person who was lost inside. I think I described Darth Vader as a mechanical sarcophagus. Yep. You know, that there's this evilness there. There's this anger. There's this rage. But when you see a friend that you used to know that you've lost lost a connection with, you can't help but think of like the person they used to be. And is that person still in there? And that's why you hire Hayden Christensen. So I think it's pretty clear we're going to see him without the mask. We're going to see the scarred, burned face at some point. That's my guess. It's not something I have intimate knowledge of.
And your hope, I would assume. Like, you want to see those two actors face to face.
Yeah. I mean, I would like to see, and literally face to face, like, my hope is that at some point there's a fight between them. And we do know, Ewan McGregor described shooting a scene where he comes face to face with Darth Vader, and he was really freaked out, like, because he was blocking the scene or rehearsing it. And then they put the mask on him, and suddenly it's like, oh, it's not an actor coming at me, it's actually Darth Vader. And he said he compared it to a scene in Big Fish where there was a lion that had to roar behind him and his like inability to act because like fight or flight kicked in. And so he was like, I was just terrified. And so I would like to see a scene where that mask gets destroyed or knocked off. It happened in Star Wars the animated series Rebels, when Ahsoka Tano, the character who's played in live action by Rosario Dawson,
we'll get more to her too. Yeah.
Yeah. She battles Darth Vader, who was her, she was apprenticed to Anakin Skywalker when he was a Jedi. So she's now, you know, a grown woman, and she's battling her old friend, her old mentor, who's now an evil tyrant. And, you know, they just kind of slash the helmet. So you see his eye come through, his human eye. And I would love for there to be some aspect of Obi-Wan seeing Anakin Skywalker's face with the mask either removed or destroyed, the way Luke saw him at the end of Return of the Jedi when he took the mask off and Darth Vader says, I want to see you with my own eyes, right? Kind of a beautiful scene. So maybe we'll get that.
It made me think of that scene at the end of Attack of the Clones. And I have not revisited those movies the way a lot of people have, but that fight with them in the lava field, which is, as far as I know, like, I don't know if that's the last time we see Obi-Wan, but it's pretty much.
So that's Revenge of the Sith, not Attack of the Clones.
Oh, I'm sorry. The last one, okay. The third one.
Yeah. I'll push up my glass. Yeah. I'm sorry. No, that's Revenge of the Sith.
This is what you're here for. but that scene is kind of silly. Like it suffers from a lot of the overdose of CGI that a lot of those prequels do, but the emotion of that scene is completely vivid, and I remember it well, even having seen it at a time when I knew even less about Star Wars than I do now. And that's the like depth of emotion that it sounds like they feel, and it sounds like, you know, the way that they talk about the emotions that showrunner Deborah Chow talks about it, that they're trying to bring to this show too.
Deborah Chow was one of the most interesting interviews I did, because I expected her to say, I fought to include Darth Vader because we really want to see these guys go head to head, you know, we want to see Godzilla versus King Kong. And instead she said, no, these two characters love each other. And I'm like, whoa, that's like not where I thought you were going to go with this. And she used those terms. She's like, they are, their lives were entwined. They were very close friends. There's a brotherhood between them. And how could you not still be thinking about this person when you were that close? And it's not that that love is not necessarily there anymore, but they did once, and that leaves a hole, right? That leaves a vacancy in your life, in your spirit. And I'm like, what a great soulful way to talk about these characters, you know?
I think that like love in Star Wars has often been a kind of abstract concept, you know. I think the relationship between Anakin and Padme has its defenders, but it's not ever something that felt especially visceral. But I think the two of them, and maybe it's because these actors had an affection that they built together, or because, you know, maybe Obi-Wan and Darth Vader are some of the most, the deepest characters in Star Wars lore. But I do think you can feel that depth of emotion with two of them. And it's really promising that that's what this show wants to dive into.
I think it's very promising, and I'm really looking forward to the show. I hope it changes our perspective on things. That's the thing that Star Wars does best when it does it. Is
perspective on things in Star Wars or outside
in Star Wars? Well, in life, hey, it's always good to see something and be changed or moved. But just sort of reevaluating our point of view on what we think we know, because I think that's what science fiction and fantasy does best, is it just adjusts your point of view enough to maybe understand your own feelings or the story that you love, or your place in the world just a little bit, and get a little extra dimension on it.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over, or even just cooking for yourself, when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
All right, a little bit more on Obi-Wan, because again, we don't know what this show is about, but watching the trailer, I'm really intrigued by Moses Ingram's role. And I think, you know, the fact that Star Wars was extremely, extremely white franchise when it started, and the shows have made increasingly better, more efforts to include not just women, but people of color in this wide range. And like, her role is intriguing and kind of mysterious and scary. And I hope that she is as major a figure in this as these two men who we've been talking about.
Oh, I think it's pretty clear that she is going to be a very prominent figure, if not the main villain, maybe the figure. There's always, Star Wars always likes to give you figures that are sort of pushed and pulled between light and dark, and good and evil. And I would not be surprised if there's a little bit of that in her. Although she is a part of this Inquisitor unit that's hunting Jedi, I think there's always potential for redemption. That's a common theme through Star Wars. And we know we're not getting that with Darth Vader just yet.
Yeah.
And I don't think you'll get it from Rupert Friend's The High Inquisitor. That guy is fully committed to the dark side, but I would be curious to see.
He's a figure we know already, right? From animated series or books or
yes,
something?
Yes, we've seen him in Rebels. He's a figure who kind of leads the unit. He's sort of the Takamata of these Inquisitors. And
you just say that like that's something I know what it is. What's that?
Oh, Takamata was the Grand Inquisitor of the a Spanish Inquisition. So I don't mean
it wasn't a Star Wars thing. That was a history thing that I did.
Yeah, that was actual history of our time. Look, I would love to sound smart, but I know who Takamata is because of Mel Brooks and the History of the World Part One, the Inquisition. The Inquisition.
What Mel Brooks show. Is also an essential part of world history, so that's fine.
I know you're wishing that we'd go away. But the Inquisitors are here and they're here to stay. And but I don't know that Reva is necessarily going to be fully committed. Like, she's the kind of character that I could see almost again. I am projecting here. Please do not listen to this and assume I'm dropping secrets on you. But I wonder if we will discover that her character is a little bit like Tommy Lee Jones's character in The Fugitive.
Oh, my God. What a dream. We need 800 more of those characters.
Where she's hunting him down. She's trying to find Obi-Wan. But then gradually, maybe she realizes, are we one of the baddies? Like, is this right? Mm-hmm. Like, or I might be totally wrong. And Moses Ingram is just going to fully commit to evil and give us a very bleak, very nihilistic Jedi Hunter. I'm down for either one of those, you know, but
yeah.
You mentioned, her background, her identity. I think, obviously that's a wonderful thing, is to make sure that everybody feels included and represented in these shows that are set in other galaxies and other times. But I'm ready to just take her as herself, as on her own merits, as just a really cool Star Wars character.
And whoever she is in this galaxy, we can't.
She's a wonderful actress. And, you know, we've seen her in The Queen's Gambit, and she's so charismatic. She's so charming. I love the idea of seeing her a little less charming, a little more intimidating. Mm-hmm. So
I mean,
no less charismatic
than. You bring up what I think is the central like challenge of this kind of show. Like, you know, with The Mandalorian, you got some sense of where you are in history, but these characters you're introduced can go wherever they want. But Obi-Wan and Darth Vader both, we know where they start and we know where they end. Like, there is a really fixed endpoint for both of these characters. And it's not like they can't change. I think with Obi-Wan especially, we're going to see him get to the point of, you know, ready to get back into the fight where we find him in the first Star Wars. But like, there's not as much growth you can do with them. So I think you have to rely on more characters, right?
Yes, exactly. Like growth and change and what will happen to this person. That was the brilliant thing with Ahsoka Tano when she was introduced to the Clone Wars animated series. George Lucas and Dave Filoni, you know, did that show together. And that's where we first met Ahsoka. And okay, well, Ahsoka's not in the original trilogy. And we don't really know what becomes of her. Does she die, you know, before those events? Like, if she doesn't die, why wouldn't she be fighting the Empire? Does she become part of the Empire? If that's the case, why isn't she fighting the rebels? Like, where is she? And it created this intense uncertainty about her. What becomes of Ahsoka? And also, we know there are no more Jedi, right? Luke meets Obi-Wan in the original 1977 Star Wars film, and the Jedi are all but extinct, right? And so does that mean Ahsoka is dead? We don't know.
Yeah.
And gradually, we've gotten an answer to that question, how she progresses beyond the era of the Clone Wars. And of course, we now know, we see her portrayed in live action as Rosario Dawson in events that take place after Return of the Jedi. So Ahsoka has been kind of existing there. So you're, you know, but she was, you know, behind the scenes, low key, working against the Empire, often as a secret agent named Fulcrum. That's some of the background on her, but I'm pointing this out just by way of agreeing with you that, yes, you need those characters whose fates are not determined, who aren't known. We know that we see the outline and the sketch, and maybe more than the sketch, but we have the drawing of Obi-Wan and Darth Vader. We know where they begin. We know when they meet. We know where they end. And I think what a show like this does for those characters that we know and are already so well defined is this adds, this colors in between those lines. This adds texture and dimension to the silhouette, or more than the silhouette than we already know.
Yeah. I wanted, like, this is a broader question about this before maybe we move on to Andor, which is the next one after this. But, you know, you take the Marvel Universe, which is introduce multiverses, and in comics have this long, long history of something happens and you undo it and it comes back, and you know, there's not that continuity. And Star Wars, from what Kathleen Kennedy told you in your piece, like, they seem pretty committed to it. It is all one story, and that gets more and more complicated the more and more shows like this that you make. Do you think that's sustainable? Do you think that is the right way for Star Wars to go?
I don't think it's sustainable for everything. This is just my opinion here. I'm not speaking for Kathy Kennedy or anything else. But right now, the books that are published, the comics that are published, the TV shows and the movies are all canon. Anything that's made now is canon. Now, there are a whole ton of games and comics and books that were written before this sort of modern renaissance for Star Wars, when Disney bought the Lucasfilm and began making new shows and stuff. And they decanonized a lot of what's called the expanded universe.
And they made a bunch of people mad, right?
Well, yeah, look, if you're getting mad about that, I think you need to change your priorities.
Sure.
There are other things worth getting mad about. Essentially, you enjoyed those books, you enjoyed those comics, you enjoyed those cartoons. But like, you know, if you're mad that they're not official anymore, that doesn't mean you can't still enjoy them. And you know, Dave Filoni loves to grab little things from that era and put them back into the shows. What that essentially means is that's their way. That's the contemporary creator's way of saying, don't box us into narratives that were written long ago. We're clearing those. They're not official anymore. You can still read them. You can still buy them. They're still in print in a lot of cases. But they're not dictating the current direction of the stories we're telling. You know,
yeah.
That's all that means. And, you know, and they bring them back in fun ways. If you remember in Solo, the standalone Solo movie, Donald Glover's Lando stays in the Falcon, in the Millennium Falcon, while they go off and explore a mine on a mission to what are they gathering? I think they're gathering some fuel rods, right?
Not a clue.
Yeah, I think they're gathering some fuel. And like, you know, he stays in there and he's seen like sort of just chilling and dictating a story. And he's narrating one of his own adventures. And like, that's taken from a novel that was published years ago. So about Lando, there was like a whole series of Lando novels, the extended adventures of Lando Calrissian. And like, I love that they bring that in. And what they call it is the expanded universe, but also legends, you know? And one of Dave Filoni's philosophies, as he's made the animated shows, is there's always a little bit of truth in legends. So we're not lassoed to that as a narrative structure, as a true history, but we can borrow things from it and we can incorporate those things from quote unquote legends and put them into the official storytelling. So Lando can tell, maybe he's writing his own novel, right? Maybe he's telling a fanciful story about himself that didn't really happen. Or maybe those stories are real and now they're being, woven back in through the movies. And, I think that Leslie Headland, who's the showrunner of the series The Acolyte that's coming up, Kathy Kennedy told me, she's reading those expanded universe books and weaving things from them into Acolyte, which, again, those people that you mentioned are mad that their stories that they bought or have on their shelves are no longer official. Well, they might be official again. You just got to give the contemporary creators a chance to just pick and choose. And frankly, Marvel is doing this too. You know, they had those Netflix shows. They had Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. The Netflix shows were like Luke Cage and Jessica Jones and Daredevil. Now. They're not part of the canon, but look, they brought Charlie Cox back as Daredevil in the most recent Spider-Man movie. Now, that doesn't mean that all of the Daredevil shows, all those episodes are canon. But it sounds like moving forward, they're going to use him and sort of recanonize his version of the character. So they're going to keep parts of it and they might cast off other parts. That doesn't mean you can't still watch Daredevil and enjoy it. It's still there. Yep. It's not being destroyed. It's not like, frankly, George Lucas saying there's not going to be the old version of Star Wars. Now there's just the revised version.
Which is still the case, right? Like, can you see the original version of Star Wars these days?
I think you can bootleg it a bunch of places, but I don't know that they've ever put out the original.
That's so crazy, right?
I
know this is a detour, but man.
I can tell you, as somebody who wrote a book years ago, that I made edits between the hardback and the paperback. I mostly fixing little like typos or something, but like the proofreaders missed the first time, but it added like one line to it. And I would prefer, whenever a friend is reading it, I'm like, oh, you should read the paperback version.
I would call that different from inserting CGI creatures in the background of Tatooine, but who am I to say?
Francis Coppola is revising a lot of his older movies and just, I can do that a little better. And, you don't have to love that, but that is a thing that creative people want
to
do.
Right to do it. Let's talk about Andor, which is the next series that will be debuting on Disney Plus sometime this summer, I believe. So
late summer, I would look for it.
August-ish.
At
the same time that Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones shows are going to be premiering. That is going to be a boom time. I guess check back here in a few months for maybe as much coverage as
we can. We'll be spending less time with our loved ones while we watch all the TV we have to watch.
Sounds great. So Andor is an interesting case because it's another story with a fixed ending. We saw Cassian Andor in Rogue One. We know that he dies in Rogue One. Spoiler alert. But there does seem to be a little bit more room to play around. And I thought the way that Tony Gilroy, he's the showrunner, Diego Luna talked about it in your piece, like it sounds like it might even be a different genre than some of the other Star Wars. Like they say, they sound really ambitious about how they want this show to go.
Yeah, it's longer. There are 12 episodes and a second season of 12 episodes. It's already in pre-production.
And so are they only doing two seasons? Like, is there like a set 24 episode plan?
Well, he said, Gilroy told me that this was leading right into Rogue One, the second season.
They do have a hard out on when they
There was talk like, well, maybe this will be five seasons. There were like some rumors. I think there was one of the crew members said like, oh, I think it's going to be three seasons. I don't think that has changed necessarily. I think what may have changed is the way they're bundling them. So if you think about it,
12 episodes is long for a modern TV series.
12 episodes is long. Yeah. Obi-Wan's just going to be, I think it's 6 episodes.
And that was a firm miniseries, right? Like, there's no one talking about a second season of Obi-Wan, at least
not
yet. No,
but, you know, look, this picks up 10 years into his exile, which means there's 10 more years of storytelling
if they want. Big Little Lies prove that you can make a second season if you want to.
But you are kind of running out of runway.
Yes.
You know, and one of the things Kathy Kennedy told me is we can't keep chipping away at the era that George explored. Like, we can explore some of this stuff, but eventually we're going to have to move beyond it. Or to different characters, because you do start to just, you know, you keep adding on and adding on until you kind of close yourself in. And they're getting there with Obi-Wan. You know, there isn't a whole lot of room left to explore what he's been up to. But, you know, that said, you can always find something somewhere. I always think of the Beauty and the Beast Christmas sequel from Disney Animation.
And, wow.
I forget the exact name of it, but it's like, well, how is there a Beauty and the Beast sequel? He turns back into a prince at the end of the movie. And it's like, the logic of it is, yes, but she was in that castle for a long time. And during that time, Christmas happened. So this story is the whole story you didn't see that happens within the context, bookended by either end of Beauty and the Beast. And so okay, you can always parse that a little bit. Shave it just a little finer, you know, like the garlic.
But with Andor, though, they do have a lot of room to explore.
Yes. And they're telling 24 episodes of TV, which in terms of the old network format is one season.
Yeah.
Or maybe you could get 4 seasons out of that if you only do 6 episodes. And it sounds like they just are like, well, why do that? Let's just give you 2 seasons, 12 episodes each. I think it's one pizza, and it's just a matter of how you're slicing it up in terms of seasons. And so I don't think that necessarily a lot has changed with Andor, except that they're just going to give it in 2 parts.
So I want to make you an offer, and you don't have to take me up on it. But in your piece, you kind of get into some of the details of Andor that they were willing to share and say, if you're a Star Wars fan, some of this may be ringing a bell, like not to spoil anything for anyone. Mm-hmm. Now, here in the safety of this podcast, do you want to make some of those connections for me of what seems like it is echoing other things in Star Wars? Because it all went over my head.
Okay, what you're talking about, the bonus story I did with Tony Gilroy?
I think so, where like he talks about, you know, he says, our show starts with a very simple, almost film noir situation for a thief. A skeevy kind of guy gets in big trouble, tries to sell something he has to save his ass. Mm-hmm. And I'm imagining that's Cassian Andor, how we meet him, because we talk about how he kind of lived his life as a refugee. And the season tracks his decision to fight the Empire. Does that feel like it's a reference to something else that exists in Star Wars lore?
Well, one thing it does is it echoes and parallels what Felicity Jones's character, Jyn Erso, does in Rogue One. Essentially, the rebellion is keeping an eye on and recruiting people who live outside the law. So you've already shown a propensity to resist authority. What can you do for us? You want to fight back and make a real mark, you know?
Yeah.
So that I think is kind of interesting, that that's where they're drawing their talent is from people who are willing to live outside the law. And I think of something like Fritz Lang's movie M, right? Mm-hmm. Which was about the underworld. I think, is it in Berlin?
I think so.
You know, the thieves and the gamblers and the prostitutes and the bootleggers. You know, there's a guy going around killing children. And so the police are cracking down on everybody. Mm-hmm. And so it's the underworld figures who say, well, we got to find this killer ourselves so that we can get back to business. You know, the businesses that don't prey upon children and leave their balls bouncing alone in the street while they vanish. Yeah. Like, so, you know, I don't know that that's an exact parallel, but I do think it's interesting that the rebellion is like fueled by outlaws. Even Han Solo is
Han Solo, yeah.
He was a smuggler, and, you know, he was not a lot allied with the rebels. You know, he was kind of in it for himself. That was what made his character so interesting. But obviously, he became a general, right? So like,
I always think of the way that Tracy Jordan on 30 Rock describes Han Solo, where it's like, you think he doesn't care, but he does.
It never gets old.
And
I think that's what they're talking about here with Andor, is that this is a guy who... He decides, I'm gonna look out for myself. You know, the Empire is stomping all over people. And look, this is what happens in fascist regimes, is you have people who say, I can't change this, or I tried, it didn't work, now I'm going to keep my head down and save my own skin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a real phenomenon. There are the people who keep their heads down and try to live. There are people who stick their necks off. A lot of times they get their head chopped off. And so, mm-hmm. you know, what is Andor's relationship to that? He's a nihilist. We hear all this stuff about how he doesn't care. I think Tony Gilroy says he could give a shit about any of that, which I thought was like, I love when you get a quote like that. This is very blunt and not very, you know, clearly that is not a press release. That's not press release language.
That's what journalism is, man. You get those people to say what they really think.
That's what journalism is. Getting a source to say a swear. And but I, you know, it has a lot of speaking parts, and it also, I made the comparison. Tony Gilroy did not make this comparison, but as he was describing it to me, and as I was listening to the transcript, listening to the interview, reading the transcript, I kept thinking of Better Call Saul,
because I love that part of it.
That's also a story that, like, it focuses on a kind of, you know, guy who's not really following the rules and living outside the law, who gets drawn in deeper and deeper. Now, it's not an exact corollary, not the same kind of story. But you also have these other stories where you have Gus Fring and you have the cartel stories, which kind of are a melody that's playing and interweaving with the, you know, the rhythms of Saul's story, of Jimmy / Saul Goodman's story. And they have a parallel story in Andor that focuses on the political movement, the leadership of the rebellion, and how that emerges from the actual formerly legitimate political class. You know, so you've got street level people like Andor hustling, selling. It sounds like he's like stolen something and is selling stolen goods. And then you have somebody like Mon Mothma, who's also featured in our Annie Leibovitz photo spread, played by Genevieve O'Reilly.
What a name and what a look. Like, that is, Star Wars has always been so good at like giving someone a name that makes no sense, but you look at them, you're like, yeah, that's a Mon Mothma.
Mon Mothma. I always thought there was something motherly about that name, right? Maybe it's just the M's, you know, like mom, Mon, Darth, Dark Vader, Darth Father. And she's clad in white. She just looks like your mom on vacation at the beach. All she needs is a little green visor.
Oh my God.
And casual fans may remember this character from Return of the Jedi. She's in one scene, played by Carolyn Blackiston back then in the 80s. And she does the briefing and says, they've rebuilt the Death Star. It's back. It's incomplete. Might be operational, might not, but we have the plans and we got to blow this one up too. And she says, many Bothans died to bring us this information. To this day, nearly 40 years later, we do not know what a Bothan is. There's no illustration of them. They were in a video game, but they were like translucent. They could disappear. So we've not really seen them. And we don't really know who they are or how many died. How many were left? You know, what is a Bothan? Is that just like a planetary distinction? The way, like, you know, I'm a Southern Californian, or is that like a species? Like, what is it? We don't know, but that's the line that made Mon Mothma famous.
And how do you account for, like, 'cause I think that line is fantastic too, but I don't know why. Like, why does many Bothans die just like roll around in your head like that?
Because it, like I said earlier, it's the outline of a story without being the actual story. I think it functions in the same way as Alec Guinness telling Mark Hamill, your father and I fought together in the Clone Wars. Now we have seven seasons of animation that tell us exactly what the Clone Wars are. We saw it in, we saw the wars begin in Attack of the Clones. We saw the resolution in Revenge of the Sith. Now we know everything about that. But at the time it was like, I fought with your father in the Clone Wars? Like, what are the... What is that? You know, like, it's tantalizing. So the notion many Bothans died to bring us this information is like, what happened? Like, that sounds ominous. You know, like, okay, how many is many? And what's a Bothan? And what happened?
Do you think we'll get Bothans? And I know this is just your guess. So, like, are you hoping that there'll be Bothans, or do we want it to stay a mystery?
Well, there wouldn't be Bothans in this story, or maybe there are. I mean, they're going to be somewhere.
They could have been around forever, right?
They could have been around forever. Maybe we'll finally figure that out. But the Bothans, that line comes after Empire Strikes Back. So this is like Return of the Jedi, not...
Yeah, well, after Cassian Andor died.
Cassian Andor's story ends with the very start of 1977 Star Wars. You know, they hand off the file that Cassian helps steal, and that's what Princess Leia stashes in R2-D2 when her ship is overtaken by Darth Vader. So, you know, that's where his story ends, and they're not doing any kind of retcon where, no, he survived the blast that destroyed that world.
Nope. Yeah, nobody would that, right?
I think that would eliminate the sacrifice that was made. Like, you could bring Mace Windu back. That's the Jedi played by Sam Jackson, because he got thrown out a window. And like, oh, the idea that he returns, or Darth Maul cut in half, but then he lives for a while as a mechanical spider, and then he, you know, he uses prosthetic legs and comes back as a gang.
Did that happen?
Yeah, that really happened.
When did that happen?
That happened in the animation, is that he ended up with these sort of like lower limbs that were like spider-like or crab-like.
And because he shows up in Solo, right? And like that was.
And then he shows up in Solo, and people are like, how is this dude alive? We saw him get like bisected. And that's how he lived, is he was cut off at the waist, and he now has prosthetic legs, and he used to have like mechanical crab legs. And now, you know, he's bipedal again. And you know, we know from Star Wars that that's a thing. Luke gets his hand cut off and they reattach a mechanical one. Darth Vader is mostly, I don't think he has any of his limbs now. He's all mechanical, just sort of the core, his head and torso are humanish. And
okay. Wait, I need to bring us back to Andor.
Let's go back.
Well, so I feel like Rogue One has had a really interesting legacy, because it was the first Star Wars movie that kind of got off of the Skywalker saga. I think it was a hit, but kind of had an odd reception. And then maybe Solo came out and kind of people thought were even more disappointing. But I think it's had a lot more defenders over the years. Are you with the people who are like, okay, at last, justice for Rogue One. Now we can, you know, finally appreciate this story.
Rogue One was pretty well appreciated in its time. I think its esteem has just grown.
Am as opposed to Solo. Wrong? I feel like it was controversial.
I think you might be reading that one.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Pull a Marge Gunderson. I'm not sure I agree 100% with your police work on that one. But I think it was pretty well received. So this is what you might be picking up on, is there was a lot of controversy about Rogue One before it came out, because there were all of these rumors about reshoots.
Oh, yes. That the production was famously messy.
And it was famously messy. And I remember writing, like, seeing some of these reports come out, and it was like, they're reshooting 30% of the movie. They're reshooting 50% of the movie. They're reshooting 90% of the movie. And it was like, okay, at that point, I started checking in with my sources. And this was, you know, the story report I ended up doing was controversial, because there were a lot of our fellow journalists who were out there saying, like, I've heard, like, it's all like completely being reshot. And my reporting showed, well, they're bringing in Tony Gilroy. They are reshooting new scenes. There is a whole month of reshoots planned, partly because it's such a big cast that it was hard to get everybody back at the same time. And you don't need everybody back at the same time, because it's not all group shots, right? Sometimes it's just, you know, it's Felicity Jones and Diego, and it's Felicity and, you know, this character or these two characters together. And so they had a month of reshoots, which is extensive, but they weren't reshooting like 80% of that movie. What they were doing is they restructured it. And what had originally happened was they went up one tower and got the plans. And then they came down that tower, ran across a beach, and went up another tower to transmit them. And they realized this is too long. This is a little too complicated. We don't have enough character building. And I had a source that told me there's a lot of reshoots that are talking in cockpits. So it was people, like, scenes where characters talk about their past or why they're doing this, that were, I thought, kind of expertly woven in, but they were added on after the fact. And so there were all of these problems there. But also the notion that it was massively rewritten or over, like, they basically did a different version of the entirely different version of the movie. Like, that's partly true, but that's also like the rewriting process, you know? And then it came out, it was very well received, but I do think that notion of it being a troubled production did stick. So that might be what you're thinking. Now, Solo was one that came out, and I feel there was a lot of like, and you could say that had to do with the release date or the marketing, maybe.
Or but its also, own famously troubled production where the directors were fired.
Yeah, the directors were let go, and Lord and Miller were let go. Ron Howard was brought in to take it over. But also you have an actor, Alden Ehrenreich, who was not especially well known. stepping into one of the most famous roles of all time, played by one of the most famous actors of all time. And I think he did a great job. I think he's wonderful. And there are some clunky things in that film, as there are with all Star Wars movies. But there were a fair number of people who just like didn't feel that that was their Han Solo. And you can see evidence of that in the YouTube videos that people have made with like deep fakes replacing his face with Harrison Ford. It's like, oh, imagine, you know, or like you could have cast this other actor who looked more like Harrison Ford. I'm not hung up on that personally. But I know a lot of people were, and that, you know, is something that the producers of these films have to take into account. A very loud group of people saying, oh, I don't recast classic roles, right? I asked Kathy.
So I was just going to ask if you wanted to talk about asking Kathy Kennedy about this, because it got a lot of attention from your piece.
Yeah, it got a lot of attention, got a lot of attacks, I would say. I hesitate to call it criticism because I think a lot of it was not... I don't think they were actually reading what was said.
Reading comprehension, like, on the internet, not always what it should be.
Well, it's just like one person says the story, says they're never going to recast characters again. Well, she didn't say that. What she said was, we're not going to do Luke Skywalker without Mark Hamill's involvement. And they create Luke Skywalker in sort of supporting cameo appearances on Mandalorian and Book of Boba Fett using Mark as reference. He's on set. He's in costume. He performs it. He helps almost with the direction of it. Like, this is how I would do it. They have a younger actor who looks sort of like him stand in. They augment the voice in ways that approximates how he sounded when he was a younger guy, 30-some years ago.
Do they augment his voice for that? I've actually never known how.
I think they've rebuilt it in some way. And it's like, I'm not entirely sure, so I don't want to comment on it. I'd be speculating. Sure. But it's a hybrid. It's a technological achievement, and it's a team effort. And that's how I described it in our story. Mm-hmm. And when I said, like, this notion that you don't want to recast Luke Skywalker, was that something born from Solo? And I even framed it as like, I don't want to put you on the spot. I don't want you to walk into a landmine here. I also said, I don't want to trash Alden Ehrenreich.
Yeah.
But of course that, you know, was that a lesson you learned from Solo, that there were people who didn't really want to see the character they already know recast? And that's common with a lot of things. Nobody wants to see Rick from Casablanca played by a different actor than Humphrey Bogart. I didn't think this was so controversial. I thought it was interesting that, like, now we have the technology to sort of recreate actors for bit parts. You wouldn't do Solo with a digitized Han Solo looking like Harrison Ford. I think that would be prohibitive.
Yeah.
But you might have Luke Skywalker turn up in The Mandalorian for a few minutes, for 9 minutes.
Yeah.
And, you know, the internet really ran with it. And I'm not on social, but I picked up on some of this just because it was so noisy. And a lot of other outlets wrote it up. And I think they really overstated what she said. And granted, the whole breadth of our conversation there was not in the main story. It was like a portion of her quote.
And now people can read the whole breadth of the conversation.
And then the whole Q&A went up, and I made sure that part was verbatim, like the whole framing of the question. You could listen to the audio if you wanted. All of her ums and maybes, you know, were woven in there. And I think, you know, interestingly, like that I think it kind of chilled people out. Like, oh, okay, she's thinking out loud and she's talking about, you know, how they have to weigh the many different reactions. Unfortunately, you know, and this is what I really despise about Twitter, is it amplified the worst, least charitable perspective on what was being commented on. And then people like really let their they overreacted to it, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't mind saying that. Like, it was an overreaction. There were people even theorizing that I set her up and that she wasn't even talking about Solo. She just said, we've learned various lessons, and that I was set. And I'm like, okay, well, that's not what happened. Like, that would be out of context. And I think the full context of the question, you know, I'm bringing my personal feelings into this now, but like, you know, it's not nice to be accused of like misrepresentation, you know, and that's dishonest and not true. And that's a pretty terrible thing to throw out casually. And I think I've proven that that's not the case, but also like, she wasn't throwing him under a bus. She wasn't trashing him. She wasn't blaming the movie on him. But
She's far too smart and far too experienced in Hollywood to do something like
that. You know, we're trying to figure how we're going to present legacy characters, whether we present them, whether we explore them at all, like whether we need to move fully beyond Skywalker. And unfortunately, I don't know how we solve this problem. I think it exists not just in Star Wars, but across every subject, is everybody overreacts to everything. It's
sure.
It's fun to overreact, I guess, isn't it? It's fun to get mad.
Let's go back to Andor real quick before we then, I guess, breeze through the rest of the Star Wars slate. The thing that intrigued me in your piece, and tell me if I'm reading this right, that Mon Mothma's story is going to be on Coruscant. Like, that's where the head of the, not the Empire, whatever, the government that she is part of at that point in the story, or the resistance that she's part of. And Coruscant, I remember from one of the prequels, as like, you know, this big Star Wars city. And I don't feel like we saw enough of it. I feel really intrigued by the idea of revisiting that planet specifically.
Yeah. That's like, you know, in Star Wars, every planet has like one ecosystem or one geographic feature. It's like the snow planet, the forest moon. And Coruscant is like a metropolis planet. Like the whole planet is a city. And it has the upper levels, which is sort of like the ruling class, the wealthy, and the Jedi, you know, the Jedi Temple, the Galactic Senate. And then it has the underclass, literally underclass, like they live in the layers sort of closer to the core of the planet. And Mon Mothma, you know, that was, so that was the subject of the George Lucas series, live action Star Wars series, Underworld, that never got off the ground back in the early 2000s, late 2000s and early 2010s, was going to be set in those sort of, those lower levels of Coruscant. And where Mon Mothma exists is she's still a senator. She's trying to control, you know, all those people who during the Trump era were like, we're trying to change the system from within.
I'm
you
the
know,
resistance
we're
trying to find, from within the Trump administration.
I'm the resistance within. Like, so she's trying to manage the Empire and the Emperor from the Galactic Senate. But she is gradually becoming a rebellion leader.
Mm-hmm.
And what Gilroy said, he didn't have to say, and it really surprised me, was they don't meet in the first season. That's when my mind really started to think of Better Call Saul, because if you think of the character of Mike, right, like that sort of gritty, hard-bitten fixer who is so interwoven with the Saul character in Breaking Bad, but in Better Call Saul, you know, the two know each other and they interact a lot in the early seasons, but now in the later seasons Mike is off kind of doing his own thing, and like they only occasionally cross paths with the Saul Goodman character. And I think Mon Mothma, she's going to be, I don't know, like have her own storyline, like in the Galactic Senate, while Cassian Andor is building his way up from street criminal to rebel spy.
That's a hard thing to pull off. You know, I think like people can really tune out when stories are parallel in that way and don't intersect enough. I'm interested to see how they meet that challenge.
I think you have to make the intersections really interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that you can tolerate like, okay, over here a different thing is happening, but at a certain point those have to collide and have an impact on each other, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of watching two cars traveling down very long roads, and you know they're going to crash at this intersection. You're just waiting for that crash and watching them build speed. And so there has to be the dramatic tension of, we know eventually they will meet. So what is it that's going to bring them together?
Well, I imagine that's how Obi-Wan will function in a lot of ways too. Like, you're waiting for the moment when they come face to face again. But I would guess they're going to make us wait a little while in that season before that happens.
You got to build it up, right?
Yeah. Okay, let's jump further into the future. I mean, you mentioned the Mandalorian in your story, but there's not a ton of detail about it. You know, there's less to learn because we've been in that world. But anything in particular from Mandalorian that we should anticipate, or even how it overlaps with any of this?
Well, I think what I can tell you is that when I visited the volume and visited the set, they were shooting Mandalorian volume or part three, chapter three, season three. And, you know, I saw the set. Well, I can reveal what was on the set. I can say there's a fight happening, and it's inside of, I can say who's fighting, but I don't think that gives away too much, right? There's got to be a fight. They aren't solving their problems with words.
That
in the
show
galaxy,
has been known to have some fights.
But there's you know, it's sort of inside of a cavern that has these sort of tech components built into the wall. So it's some place that's, you know, has some sort of human or alien. Yeah, when I say human, I mean, like, look, the Wookiees and all of these other creatures, they all exist sort of as humans, right? The sentient beings have constructed something inside of this cavern. And so That's what you're going to see there. That doesn't tell you much about Mandalorian season 3, except that we know the child and Din Djarin and the character played by Pedro Pascal are going to continue their relationship. There's a father-son thing happening there. And here's what I think I can tease might be interesting to people. In the story, Kathy Kennedy notes that, you know, she brought Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni together to work on The Mandalorian.
Mm-hmm.
Filoni, as I said, he was the apprentice of George Lucas. He came on to work in animation, steeped in Star Wars lore, has ambitions to direct live action. She put them together, and Dave and Jon revealed to me, well, one of the reasons she put them together is they both had ideas about Mandalorians. Jon Favreau had this idea of like a lone gunslinger, the story we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
A bounty hunter who pairs up with this child and has to figure out how to take care of it. And Filoni was interested in expanding upon the Clone Wars and the Mandalorian characters that he featured there, who were, you know, part of the leadership royal family of Mandalore. And he hinted at, and eventually they revealed, some of the destruction of that planet that really scattered the Mandalorians and made them rare in the galaxy. They were mm-hmm. a planet of people. And where did they all go? You know, they're the victim of a galactic genocide. It's the only word. And a whole planet is basically exterminated.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to explore like the leadership and the history of the Mandalorian people, almost like a royal, I don't know, but like a six. Again, this is me, not him, describing it. But think of Succession, like the power players of the Mandalorian world, like and how they interact. And I. You know, we've seen Katie Sackhoff from Battlestar Galactica turn up as this character Bo-Katan in The Mandalorian.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the characters that Dave, you know, helped create and is really interested in, and her relationship to her family and the dark saber that is at the core of The Mandalorian. Like, that is like a royal object. Whoever holds that, like, they have to win it in battle. And it's sort of like, it's almost like winning the mantle of mm-hmm. leadership. Think of like Black Panther and how Black Panther in the Marvel universe can be challenged. And if you defeat him, maybe you're the next Black Panther.
Yeah.
There's an aspect to that that's woven into the Mandalorian. So I would expect that to come to fruition too, is we're going to see that dark saber. We're going to see probably more Mandalorians. And I would bet good money that Bo-Katan and Katie Sackhoff return.
Okay.
You know, and what exactly it means to be a Mandalorian and what becomes of those people. That's the trajectory of this show. I don't think I'm spoiling anything.
Yeah.
To say that that's where it's headed. And that's, you know, if they go off and it's just like a cooking show between Mando and Baby Yoda, I think that
I would watch it.
I would still watch it, but that would be a sharp turn from where they're
surprise. Been headed. Well, that's what I've enjoyed about that show so much. It's like, as someone who doesn't know a ton about Star Wars, the episodic nature of it and the way that it can kind of twist and turn and always return to that dynamic between the two of them. It really keeps me going with it. And I never know what's going to happen next.
Star Wars has to keep it casual.
Mm.
It has to keep inviting people like you into that world instead of closing it off. Sometimes I think the gravity of the hardcore fans can be overwhelming. They want things to go super deep. They want this in Marvel, too. It's not just Star Wars. You know, there's all this theorizing every time a Marvel trailer comes out about what secret thing is going to be revealed. And it's like, usually it's just the bad guy you expect. And there's a big fight at the end. Like, they very rarely deliver the mind blowing, mind bending lore that some of the hardcore fans anticipate and speculate about. And that's because most people would be lost if they did that. You know, I'm here telling you about Mandalorian history and the Darksaber, but I'm trying to contextualize it in a way that you'll be able to follow.
And if you introduce it in the context of a show, if you lead me to it within the show that I'm watching, then I'll go there. But you can't. The homework aspect of it is what you can't expect from people.
You can't. And I think Star Wars has to keep that casual. And the fans who want it to be like this deep, dark dive, this dense dive into lore that you can get in expanded universe things like books, or you can spend that time on it. They don't realize that the story has to keep moving. It has to be exciting. It has to be in the moment, not rehashing thousands of years of history. you can build in a little. Every story has a certain structure to it that allows you to to weigh some exposition on top. You know, I just did a Q&A with the team that made Loki, and Michael Waldron, the head writer on Loki, said they created Miss Minutes, the little animated clock on that series, just so they could explain some of the logic in a quick way.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, and you know, and Loki, so I probably follow Marvel about as extensively as I do Star Wars, where I watch a lot, but I don't like catch up on the lore. And I loved Loki. And I think exactly because they were successful in doing what you're talking about.
So the fans that want, they always sort of turn up their nose at fan service, like little lines or references or things like that. They like almost like those are cheap, but they want these deep, introspective dives, and like, I'm sorry, but you would lose the mainstream audience, and you need the mainstream audience because somebody's got to pay for these movies and these TV shows.
And like, you want your show to be for a lot of people, and I think, you know, there are a lot of times, like, you know, when Harry Styles shows up at the end of whichever Marvel he showed up at the end of, and I had no clue who he was, but people were satisfied by it. I can accept, like, all right, that's something I don't get, but I get that he's a scary guy and move on. Like, there are ways to loop it in there without losing people like me.
And you know what? Marvel does that. And I think there's actually, I don't know this for sure, nobody's ever articulated it to me, but I think there's a strategy involved. Mm-hmm. Let's dive into the books, the comic books. Let's pull out a couple characters that mainstream people don't know. Harry Styles is playing this character. And you might not know who he is at the end, but neither do the Eternals, right? They're who is this guy?
Yeah.
And it leads people to go, all right, I'm going to look that up. And it launches 1,000 articles of Harry Styles' mystery cameo explained. Mm-hmm. And by the time he appears again, you're going to know who that character is, right?
Or even at the end of Loki, Jonathan Majors, who is an actor I've just adored forever, he shows up as, I used to know, it's not Kroll. What is it? What's his thing? What's his
Kang the Conqueror.
Name?
Kang. But he's not. But the thing is, he's not Kang the Conqueror.
Okay, hang on. Don't even go that far with me. I had no clue who he was, but I was like, he's charismatic. He's interesting. He's powerful. I don't know what's going on, but I'm with it.
He's playing a guy who is a scientist who discovers the multiverse. And so he creates this sort of time lord. That's another loaded phrase from Doctor Who. But like, he creates this sort of time regulation bureaucracy to prevent versions of himself from becoming tyrants and waging war between the various dimensions.
Yep.
And so he kind of becomes the thing he's trying to prevent, like a kind of time tyrant.
Yeah.
They kill him at the end. Spoiler alert. Sorry, a little late there. And what he says is, well, you're going to be seeing me again.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's, that version of the character is called He Who Remains. Very spooky kind of title for him. What it implies, and we know that Jonathan Majors will be playing this character, Kang the Conqueror, who's just like a bad guy, a tyrant, like who exists in the Marvel Universe. And basically, you've killed me. Now all of the other me's and the other dimensions are going to run amok. And one of those will be Kang the Conqueror.
Okay, and see, I'm learning something.
So now you know, and knowing's half the battle. but that's what Marvel does, is they introduce these characters in little cameos and make you go, well, who is that Charlize Theron character? And by the time she shows up, we've done a lot of the heavy lifting of explaining it to people, you know?
Well, this actually leads great to talking about Ahsoka, which is the next show is coming in 2023, because she's somebody who, when she shows up in The Mandalorian, she shows up in season one, right? Near the end of season one? Okay. So she shows up and I'm like, all right, this is someone who people know, but Rosario Dawson and the show itself, I think, in her really brief appearances, do a really good job of like establishing her as a competent Jedi, as someone who you want to follow through the world, as someone who has charisma all her own. So then I see that her show, you know, it'll be kind of a continuous story, I think is what they said, not standalones like The Mandalorian. And it'll follow on plots about her from the Clone Wars. But I feel like I already know her enough that I don't need to have that background to understand the show.
You don't. You picked up all of the things you need to know about Ahsoka. And if there's more you want to know, may I present seven seasons of the Clone Wars to you? And not only the Clone Wars, she then turns up as an important character in Rebels. So there are multiple seasons of that will tell you her full backstory. But it's kind of like meeting a person in real life. Like when you and I met for the first time, you don't know everything about me.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually over time, you learn this or that, and you know what you need to know. And then the more you become friends with somebody, the more you learn about who they are.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is sort of the way you have to present characters, is you can't have her pop up and have everybody go, oh, right. Like, there will be some people who know who she is and know her background. But otherwise, you've got to have somebody like the Mandalorian who's like, well, who are you?
Yeah.
You know, and she kind of explains that. And I think that's a really good thing.
Yeah. So we don't know a ton about her show either. Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Lucasfilm will not confirm whether she's on it, but her husband, Ewan McGregor, will in your piece.
She's on it. They were like, well, I guess you've got that one. Like, because, you know, because there's always a fight. Like, can we get a little more news in this story? Reveals. And everybody's very good about not teasing things. But Ewan McGregor was just like, yeah, you know, Mary's going to be on Ahsoka, which had been rumored. But yeah, I mean, look, Lucasfilm was like, okay, they're not denying it.
Well, but the same similar thing with Hayden Christensen, where they wouldn't confirm that he's on it, but Rosario Dawson seemed to confirm that he's on it. That seems thorny.
That's a little bit more vague. The story she told me was she read a trade report that said Hayden Christensen will be returning as Anakin Skywalker in the Ahsoka series. And it makes sense. He was her mentor, and I think she will be haunted by what happened to Anakin Skywalker.
So it'll be in flashbacks that he would appear on it, something like that.
But yeah, but Vader is dead by the time we see her in Mandalorian, right?
Okay.
It's not like Vader himself will be popping up unless Ahsoka is set before his death, right? Which is also a possibility, frankly.
We don't know when it's set.
We do have the implication. What Dave Filoni told me was, I'm continuing the story that we're introducing. Like, they're laying a little bit of foundation and exposition with her appearance in The Mandalorian and her appearance in Book of Boba Fett. We know she's searching for this scary imperial figure known as Thrawn,
mm-hmm.
who has a huge legacy in all those expanded universe books that I talked about. But otherwise, you don't know who Thrawn is.
No,
and you don't have to know. You need to know he's a scary imperial guy and she's trying to find him. Now, if you watch the animated shows, you'll realize when he vanishes, he's kind of lost at sea. His starship gets, in a way that's too complicated to explain, gets blasted off into deep space, lost at sea, lost in space. And with him goes the hero, the young hero of Rebels, a character named Ezra Bridger, who was a criminal, a little thief, a young child thief, street kid, who rises up and becomes through the ranks to become like a rebel, one of the original rebel leaders, or soldiers, and early on at the start of the rebellion. So he vanishes along with this big bad guy. So when she says in The Mandalorian to the villain that she's fighting, "I want to know where Thrawn is,"
everybody
who watched that was like, she's trying to find her friend Ezra. Like, why else would she be looking for Thrawn? Well, there are a million reasons she might be looking for Thrawn, but a good guess is she wants to track him down to find out what happened to the other guy who disappeared.
So she's continuing her story of where she was left at the end of Clone Wars.
Yeah, and Dave Filoni said, that's a hint of where this story is going. Her episodes will not just be standalone little Ahsoka going through the galaxy like the A-Team, visiting planet after planet,
well,
like helping the folks.
That's kind of what The Mandalorian is, but I don't think you can have all of the shows be that, right?
No, you can't. Yeah, you can have sort of this week's episode, but I think Ahsoka already is just part of such a much larger narrative. And, you know, the end of Rebels featured her aged up and in a white costume, implying that she is somehow like elevated or changed. Like, she's a changed person when we see her there, just a brief glimpse. And I think what the Ahsoka live action series will do is in some way show us how she goes from the character of this sort of wandering Ronin that we see in The Mandalorian to this sort of wise, sort of almost otherworldly figure.
Yeah.
Still at that point, though, looking for Ezra.
Which
sounds like a 90s band.
I know. But also, like, when you have the plot of like this powerful person who you know already is trying to find somebody, like, that is a quest narrative that you can jump into immediately, even if you don't have the background for it.
And you don't need the background. Like, you can figure out that background. You can figure out why this ring has to be thrown into a volcano. I'll tell you on the way, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of what it is.
Okay, let's do the last show. Well, I guess there's two shows. There's the Grammar Rodeo, which is the John Watts show that we really don't know much about at all. Possibly an Amblin style Goonies-esque vibe, right?
Yes. That's what I got officially from people at Lucasfilm. It stars some of its main characters are kids, but that doesn't mean they're the solo leads. There might be other adult characters, but we know that there was a casting announcement for four children, four young, like tweenish age kids. Mm-hmm. And the name Grammar Rodeo refers to an episode of The Simpsons where Bart and his pals illegally rent a car and go on a road trip to Tennessee. And
great.
And they tell their parents that they're going, that they have like an academic trip planned, that they're going to the Grammar Rodeo. And and so what that with these titles, you know, these code name titles are not meant to give things away, but they kind of imply things. Like the code title for the Avengers was Group Hug. So there's always something like a little bit ironic about them, you know?
Sure.
And I think, okay, now that we know that there are like a lot of kid characters in this, it's the idea of kids going
going on an adventure.
Going on an adventure that's not sanctioned, right? That maybe doesn't have chaperones on it. I think that's my guess. And John Watts, who, you know, made the Spider-Man, the new Spider-Man films with Tom Holland, like he's good with young people. He's good, mm-hmm. got those YA chops in a way.
And he walked away from a Marvel project, presumably to make this.
I guess they're kind of happening at the same time, and maybe just Fantastic Four was too much for him. We don't really know why that didn't happen or what went wrong, but people are always horse trading on big titles. You know, the guys who made Game of Thrones signed up to make a Star Wars trilogy, then they signed a huge Netflix deal and they backed out of the Star Wars trilogy. And
well, the thing that Kathy Kennedy said in your piece is like, this is a 4 or 5 year commitment. Like, you're not doing something else while you do this.
Yeah, they don't want filmmakers coming in and saying, okay, I could spend 2 years in Star Wars land. She's like, mm-hmm. you know, we want you to come in and like do some persistent storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, they felt like there was a little bit of zigzagging with the between The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi and The Rise of Skywalker. That's not to trash any filmmaker or anybody's
No, I would say
vision.
That was pretty public. I mean, switching filmmakers and back again, that is a zigzag.
Yeah, and I noted that, you know, The Last Jedi closed off some storylines. It killed Snoke. They resolved to a degree who Rey's parents were. And like, you know, that was something... there wasn't a lot of like open space left after that. Like they had to come up with some new stuff for the third installment of that series. And you can like what Ryan did and still acknowledge that that's true, right? That kind of put a punctuation mark at the end of certain narratives that were begun in The Force Awakens. Now, you know, everybody likes to position it as the filmmakers who are at war with each other. I think it's more just like, this is the song I want to sing. This is a song you want to sing. I'm going to, you know, try and bring it back around, I guess.
Yeah. And again, an argument for keeping people in the building for as long as you can to really have things be consistent.
I don't think anybody would disagree that it's better. You know, there's maybe just a little less narrative whiplash if you have one person deciding this is where it goes.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay. Let's end on The Acolyte, which you mentioned earlier is the Leslie Headland show set 100 years before The Phantom Menace. Kind of like a Roman Empire before the fall vibe. Like if everything in Star Wars is dirty, this is everything when it was first built and it was all shiny and new.
That's how what I asked her about. And one, I want to say, I really enjoy talking to everybody in that cover story, but Leslie Headland is it.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.
From PRX.